طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, a discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that it is broadcast every week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This Week in Palestine, the voice that we feature is Palestinian-American Huwaida Araf, now residing in Michigan, where she just recently ran an unsuccessful campaign to be the
Democratic nominee for U.S. Congress
in her district. She is an attorney with strong family ties and years of activism in Palestine. Here is Huwaida Araf speaking at a forum sponsored by the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Let me tell you just a little bit about how I came to do this work. My parents are immigrants from Palestine. My father is from a village that was taken over by Israel in 1948. So it became part of Israel. Technically, we are Israeli citizens, but not treated equal by any means. And my mom is from a West Bank town of Beit Sahur, which is near Bethlehem, under full Israeli military occupation. And so when my parents were looking to start a new family, my mom was 9 months pregnant with me. I'm the oldest of five children. They made their way to this country so that I and their future children could be born in a country that would give their children opportunity and equality, a chance to become whatever we wanted to become, something that is denied to Palestinians in the land of our ancestors. My dad found a job with General Motors, was part of the union, the UAW, until he retired in 2012. My mother, a nurse, and they worked hard and were able to give us the life that they wanted us to have. We were by no means wealthy, but we weren't in want of anything. I remember how much my father worked, never turning down an opportunity to do overtime, double shifts, never missing a day of work. I remember when I was in high school seeing him getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning so that he could be at the factory by 4 in the morning. I wouldn't see him again till the next night at 7 p.m., where he'd eat, shower, go to sleep so he can get up at 2 o'clock in the morning again. And never missing a day of work, even when he had to get 16 stitches in his head because of an injury in the factory. He got stitched up and the next day went back to work. But, you know, they were able to put us, all the five children, through college. And it was in those years, recognizing the privilege that I had because of the decision that my parents made, that I started thinking about what is my responsibility to give back, especially knowing that millions of Palestinians don't have the opportunity that I have had. So in 2000, I accepted a position, a job working in Jerusalem, which is where I ended up meeting my husband, but it was a job working for a conflict resolution organization. This organization was supposed to bring together Palestinian and Israeli youth from the age of about 13 to 16. It was an age where they're old enough to understand the world and politics around them, but not too old so that they're completely jaded, because the organization wanted them to learn to talk, to understand, to break down, to break through stereotypes, to break down the walls separating people. And I came to recognize in my time there that these programs are more destructive to Palestinian liberation than they are helpful. Because while the children came together and it was beautiful, and they had their first Israeli friend or their first Palestinian friend, and these friends became their best friends because they realized that they liked the same movies or they liked the same music, they danced to the same songs, the organization did not care and in fact avoided addressing the political situation that kept these children apart. And so when the children came together at our center in Jerusalem and we had to take them back home, the Israeli would go back home to his or her city or town, likely built on top of the ruins of Palestinian village or town. And the Palestinian, when we had to take them home, they had to walk under the guns of Israeli soldiers, likely the brother or the sister of their new best friend, and walk through checkpoint after checkpoint to get home to their surrounded and militarized villages. And this program, Seeds of Peace, did not do anything to address that. In fact, when I started wanting to take children to see what a home demolition looks like in Jerusalem, I had to do that secretly because the administration would not approve of that. What these programs do is make people feel good that they're supporting a program that promotes peace and brings people together. But unless we address the root cause of what is tearing people apart, then we're not changing anything. We're making ourselves feel good that we're donating or we're supporting these people-to-people programs. And that's what our government is doing right now. In this new spending bill allocated to $250 million to these people-to-people programs that do just that, while ignoring really why Palestinians are in the situation that they're in, why there is no peace, because there is a settler colonial occupation that is killing the indigenous people, that is pushing them out of their land. And so going back to where I was, a year of working with this organization, and I ended up resigning. Shortly before I resigned, the Palestinian Intifada broke out. That was in September of 2000. It was triggered by, if any of you remember, then opposition minister Ariel Sharon, who Palestinians believe have the blood of thousands of people on his hands. He went up in a very provocative move on to the Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif, as we call it, in a show of basically disrespect to Palestinians and a show of complete control and authority, like, we can go wherever we want, even to your most holiest sites, and you can't do anything about it. And so Palestinians got angry, broke out in demonstrations. The Israeli forces fired at them live ammunition and killed 7 people on the first day of protests, which only ignited more protests and then more Israeli forces shooting at them, so that within the first month of the Intifada, which was largely unarmed Palestinian men, women, and children marching, I was in a lot of those marches, 127 people shot dead. I still am thankful that I have all my limbs. 127 people shot dead, mainly from bullet wounds to the chest and head area. So even if, you know, Israel is saying these were riots or they were trying to keep the peace, not by shooting to the head and neck area. So Palestinian popular protests died down. You know, and it wasn't because Palestinians suddenly are unafraid to die or to sacrifice for their freedom, because we've been doing it for decades. But because they recognized the larger Israeli strategy of trying to push Palestinians off their land. So a big part of Palestinian resistance today is sumud, is steadfastness. We have to stay on our land despite these policies intended to get us off. But what happened to the Intifada is it became armed. Those in Palestinian society, the political factions, started using their old weapons to shoot at Israeli military installations, at checkpoints, even at settlements, which didn't really make any strategic sense because we don't have an army, we are no match for one of the most powerful militaries in the world, but it was some way that they thought we are going to fight back. And that only gave Israel more of an excuse to come at us with their tanks and with their bulldozers and their armored personnel carriers and bombing our cities from the air, so that the casualties piled up. And I was, you know, a young, new graduate student, so idealistic and wanting to wanting to take part, wanting to get in those streets, but there were no more popular demonstrations, and I couldn't pick up a gun, so what do? I started talking to leaders of Palestinian civil society, saying and thinking that I had these great ideas, like of creative marches that we can do, and they just looked at me and calmly taught me a little bit about the history of my own people and our resistance through the years, and how Palestinians, although most people hear about us being terrorists, how most of our resistance in over 70 years has been largely nonviolent. How the height of probably Palestinian creative nonviolence in the first intifada, this one was the second intifada, and the first one was 1987 to about 1993, where Palestinians organized themselves. We didn't have the Palestinian Authority. Palestinians organized themselves in community groups and popular resistance groups that led a popular uprising. And intifada means shaking off, to shake off, shaking off the occupation, and use creative means to take back control of their lives, because the Israeli soldiers, Israeli military, controlled even when businesses opened and closed in the occupied territory. So Palestinians were taking that back by shutting down when they wanted to shut down, by doing strikes and boycotts and burning their ID cards and refusing to pay taxes in my mom's hometown of Beit Sahur, through which they were punished, and they kept organizing, distributing before the days of internet and social media, leaflets that tell everybody what we're doing on this day, when we're striking, and for what, and everybody was involved. And most of the Palestinian people that I know today, especially the men, spent a number of years of their lives in Israeli jail for being part of that organizing. But they did it proudly because it was our resistance. It was a collective resistance for our freedom. And when the Oslo Accords in 1993 were signed, that was supposed to be a peace deal, okay, Palestinians were going to give it a chance. But in those 7 years from 1993 to 2000, when I said the second intifada broke out, Israel used the cover of peace to continue colonizing the land, to expand settlements, which it's still doing today, to demolish Palestinian farmland, olive groves, demolish Palestinian homes, to push them out of Jerusalem, to connect these settlements that they're building, connecting them with superhighways that connect illegal settlement, to go around Palestinian villages that they're surrounding, with roads that are built on top of Palestinian farmland, roads that Palestinians cannot use because they're Palestinian. And so when the Intifada broke out, it wasn't just Ariel Sharon that went on the Temple Mount. It was Palestinians saying, we no longer want to be part of this facade of a peace process. This is not a peace process. But the casualties were mounting, and nobody was holding Israel accountable. And on top of that, Palestinians were being blamed for their own death, because Palestinians, you walked away from the negotiating table. Yasser Arafat is going back to his terrorist roots. That's what we heard. And the mainstream media wasn't covering it. It was Palestinians that started the violence. That's what you heard. And so when I was thinking what to do and hearing from Palestinian civil society leaders that, Hoveida, that's a good idea, but we've done that. We've done that for years, and we're tired. And so in continuing to talk and to learn, the idea came to me and others to see if we can globalize this intifada. Let's have people really see what's going on here. And so the idea was, let's invite people from all over the world to come here and stand with us. And I had these images of like thousands of people forming the civilian army and linking arms to prevent the Israeli bulldozers and tanks from rolling into Palestinian villages. And we organized for that. And when we had our first campaign, we didn't have thousands. We didn't even have hundreds. But we had 50 people that came, mainly from the United States and Europe, bringing their experience, listening to Palestinians and organizing and demonstrating with Palestinians, and then going back to their home country, telling people about what they saw, and sending more people to volunteer with us. We didn't really know what we were doing. You know, we put out some emails. Let's see if this will work. And 50 people came, and then those 50 people started the engine they went back and told people and said, organize another campaign, we're sending volunteers. So the next campaign we had 100 people come. And those people went back and wrote op-eds and told their family and friends, and more people wanted to come. At the time, we were receiving volunteers, not funded by anyone, not registered by anyone, just a group of activists connecting with other people and connecting them to Palestinian villagers. And we were sending groups to Palestinian towns and villages, and we were able to send them to Gaza at the time too, which is now almost imaginable. But what was the point that we saw of the international solidarity movement? One, international volunteers could help Palestinian, well, let me not say help, walk side by side with Palestinians in the hopes that the Israeli military would not use lethal force against unarmed demonstrators because they might not care and they might not be able to or be held accountable for Palestinian lives, but they don't want to kill an international that they can't so easily label a terrorist. So we thought protective accompaniment, one. Two, we thought, you know, the media is calling us terrorists. We want to push the Jews into the sea. We can't accept Israel. All the things that you hear about Palestinians. Well, if people come from all over the world, and not just, you know, Americans and Europeans, but also people of all different backgrounds, all different religions, can come and say to the mainstream media, I'm standing here not because I want to push the Israel into the sea or the Jews into the sea. Many of our volunteers were actually Jewish Americans, coming to say it's because I am against occupation, I am against what Israel is doing here, and I'm standing on the side of freedom, hoping the mainstream media will cover that, helping to give Palestinians a voice. But if they weren't, the mainstream media wasn't going to cover it. The third thing internationals can do is actually travel more freely, go back to their home countries and tell at least what they saw with their own eyes. People to people, we could create an alternative media that could bypass the mainstream media that censors itself. And the last thing that I saw as a strong pillar of the international solidarity movement was the hope that it gave to Palestinian civilians that feel that and really are up against one of the most powerful militaries in the world, backed by the only superpower in the world today, and feeling that nobody cares. I taught law in Jerusalem, and when my students would say, well, it was international law, like they would tell me, well, this is all nice, miss, but it doesn't apply to us. Because international law, if any of you have studied international law, implementation is all political will. And the political will, you know, is in the hands of the powerful. And we know what countries are the powerful and the bullies right now. And so Palestinians really felt like nobody's paying attention. Nobody cares. And so when you travel, and not only to see and to talk to people, but actually to stand side by side with them, and our volunteers were arrested and deported and injured. But that gives people hope that we are not alone. Somebody cares. And there was a story I will never forget. In 2002, Israel had reinvaded all Palestinian villages, and they were conducting a military operation in Nablus, going door to door in a crowded refugee camp where to reduce their exposure, I guess, from kids that would throw rocks or whatnot. They were breaking into homes, ransacking these homes, and then blowing holes in the walls of these refugee homes that are so close together so that they can go from home to home without actually having to go outside. But we got word of this military operation going on in Nablus. And I was in Jerusalem training volunteers and sending them off. Not much we can do when a military operation like that is going on, right? There isn't much we can do, but we could at least monitor. We could try to let the Israeli soldiers know that we're watching you in the hope that, again, they'll be less violent in their actions. And we sent a team to Nablus. I was in Jerusalem and my phone rang. And it was a man from Nablus. He said that he is in his home with his wife and kids, and the soldiers are going to come to his house soon. And he sees the internationals outside. He's like, I don't think that they can help me and my family. But I know that they're there. So thank you. And he hung up. And that hope is important, you know, to know that somebody cares if you are going to be able to see a tomorrow and to believe that there is something worth continuing for. We used to send people to Gaza also, but in 2003, in the spring of 2003, Israel stopped all internationals from going to Gaza because in the spring of 2003, they killed one of our volunteers, Rachel Corey, a 23-year-old college student from Olympia, Washington, who was run over by an Israeli bulldozer. 3 weeks later, they injured another of our volunteers, but in Jenin, firing shots to his face. He survived. But a week after that, they killed another volunteer, one of our volunteers in Gaza. He was sniped in the head, Tom Herndahl, a 21-year-old photography student from the UK. He was trying to move Palestinian children out of the line of Israeli fire. He bent down to pick up a child, and they shot him in the head. He lay in coma for 9 months, and then he passed. And just a few weeks after that, the Israeli military shot and killed a British journalist, James Miller. So they were getting all in this short period of time some very bad press for injuring and killing internationals. And so they stopped letting internationals go to Gaza. And we weren't able to access Gaza again until many years later. But in that time, in 2006, 2007, because Palestinians had an election and Israel didn't like who they elected, they completely sealed off Gaza. I mean, it was already surrounded and it was already difficult to get in and out, but now it was tightly controlled who came in and out, what came in and out, and they reduced the number of aid trucks coming in, of permits that they gave for people to leave, people that needed to go to school, people that needed medical attention. They destroyed the economy because not only could people not leave and aid trucks coming in were lessened, but also being able to export so that you can have an economy, the things that you create. Gaza has some of the best strawberries I've ever tasted in my life, but when you can't export them, you know. And you can't import the raw materials in order to be able to build and to create because Israel didn't let them do that. It was so ridiculous that the head of the United Nations at the time that I went in with a delegation told us, Israel turned back one of our trucks because we had shampoo and conditioner, because shampoo was allowed, but conditioner was not. And so we had some two-in-one, and they turned the truck back. But that is the kind of deliberate persecution of people that is designed to bring Palestinians to their knees. It's not about security. It's about control. It's about getting people to give up. And so reports were coming out. We were hearing the Save the Children and the UN were writing reports about Israel's closure policy was devastating the people of Gaza. We were on the brink of a humanitarian crisis, rising rates of malnutrition, stunted growth. And I was just shocked, like stunted growth in Gaza. Gaza is not poor. Gaza is not poor. Gaza is being made poor because of this deliberate policy, and nobody is doing anything about it. So when we were thinking, what can we possibly do? Because all of these reports aren't doing anything. One of our volunteers said, why don't we sail a boat to Gaza? And I said, whoa, well, we don't have a boat. And we don't have enough money to get a boat, and we know absolutely nothing about boats, so what else can we do? But, you know, as we continued discussing it, why not? Why not? Because Israel's not letting us go through Israel. Egypt was also closed off. We can't get in through there. Let's try this. Let's try to sail a boat from Cyprus to Gaza, international waters. We're not going to go into Israeli waters. And if Israel stops us, let us show the whole world that Israel's policy is not about security, because here we're not a security threat. You know, and so we worked, went into a lot of debts, but found two dilapidated fishing boats that we converted and made semi-seaworthy. And in the summer of 2008, 44 civilians from 17 different countries got ready to set sail. And I remember training people before we got on those boats. And one of the things I said is, you know what, we went through all these scenarios. Israel could injure all of you. They could try to sink our boats in the middle of the sea. Some of us might get killed. At best, maybe they'll just arrest us. And so if you're not ready for all of that, then don't get on those boats, because we're not turning back. And not one volunteer turned, stepped down. Even though I said, you know, it's not a problem. There are other groundwork that you can do. And in fact, a lot of people that stayed on the ground and people all over the world really supported our efforts by watching and providing those watchful eyes that monitored our ships. But we set sail not believing for one second that we were going to get into Gaza. But we just wanted to challenge the Navy, challenge this closure, and try to draw the world's attention to what was happening. But at the last minute, while we were out at sea and Israel had cut off all our communications and the media that we had arranged to come meet us never found us in the middle of the sea, one satellite phone that worked gave us word that the Israeli military is back down and they're not going to intercept your boats. And we realized that we were actually going to make it to Gaza. The first time any boats had done so in over 42 years without Israeli permission. And so as we got closer to Gaza, the port, and from afar I thought these were just like rocks and I don't know, seeing it from afar. But as we got closer, I realized that all those things that I thought were colorful rocks were actually thousands and thousands of people. People that had rushed to the port when they heard that our boats were coming. And they welcomed us with such open arms. In fact, young boys jumped into the sea. Men got on their fishing boats and came out to us. And I remember thinking, these boys got to get out of the sea. This water is polluted. This water is polluted because Israel does not let Palestinians import the materials that they need to address their sewage system. And so 110 million liters of untreated or partially treated sewage is dumped into the Mediterranean Sea every single day. But they came out to swim out to our boats, and when we got to sea, jumping up and down and hugging us, receiving us so warmly, even though we were mainly from Europe and the United States, the countries that give Israel cover and finances and protection at the United Nations to continue doing what it's doing, from the countries that is allowing Israel really to kill the 2 million people living in Gaza, to completely choke them off. And they welcomed us with such love and such joy that, and not because we were carrying humanitarian aid, our boats barely carried us, you know. We weren't carrying aid. We had some balloons. We had some balloons on our boat, and we had a little box of hearing aids. That's all we could carry. But they were so happy that someone was challenging that policy, the policy that was doing this to them. And so they said, you know, we broke the siege. Yeah, we chanted we broke the siege, but we knew we didn't really break the siege. To do that, we would have to keep going in and out over and over again until we opened a seaway. Maybe then we can say we broke the siege. And so we promised to do that. And when we left Gaza, we left some of our volunteers in Gaza, 8 people, to restart the international solidarity movement there. And in their place, we were able to take out some people that needed to leave, really, and were not allowed to. One of them was a 16-year-old boy, Saed, who had been injured in an Israeli military strike and had his leg amputated from the hip and was not allowed to leave to get any kind of medical attention, to get a prosthetic leg. And so we put him in his wheelchair and his father on one of our fishing boats. And the other spaces went to a mother and her 5 children, who was from Sweden, but she had family in Gaza and came to visit her family in Gaza 2 years before and then got trapped. Israel did not let her leave. So she was separated from her husband for over 2 years before we put her on our boats and were able to take them to Cyprus, when then the boy was able to get Saed was able to get a prosthetic leg, and this woman was reunited with her husband. But after that, you know, we ran a few more successful voyages. But in the winter 2008-2009, Israel launched Operation Cast Lead on Gaza. So not only is Gaza completely encircled and 2 million people are living, are trapped in an area not much larger than Fort Wayne, really. 2 million people trapped there for most of their lives, not able to leave. But then Israel comes and bombs them and destroy thousands of homes and schools and churches and mosques and businesses and factories. We tried to sail an emergency boat, and they hit our boat, nearly sank it. Actually, the Lebanese Navy or Coast Guard saved us from sinking. And then a few weeks later, we tried to take another boat, and they almost capsized that boat. So suddenly we realized, you know what? These small boats are not going to be able to get into Gaza anymore. So this tactic is not working. Either we give up or we escalate. And so we decided to escalate and plan a flotilla. And in the spring, in May of 2010, we had 7 ships, many different countries participating. We had 3 cargo ships, 4 passenger boats, 10,000 tons of cargo, of aid, of rebuilding supplies to help rebuild, because Gaza, Israel had not let Gaza import the materials it needs to rebuild all of the damaged homes and schools, and people were still homeless 2 years after a massive bombardment. And 700 people we set sail. And on May 31st, 2010, we were attacked. We were attacked by the Israeli Navy. They launched an all-out assault on our ships and killed 10 of our volunteers. One of those volunteers was a 19-year-old student. He was Turkish-American. He had just finished school and was preparing to go to med school and was really excited to be on this humanitarian voyage to Gaza. A UN independent fact-finding commission investigated what happened. They found that this young man, Furkan, and 4 others of the 10 were most likely executed because they were shot, but how the bullets entered their body at close range. Furkan, the last bullet to enter his body, was in his face. They also, this commission, found that after studying all the circumstances, that Israel's blockade on Gaza is illegal. It violates international law because the harm to civilians completely outweighs any kind of military benefit that Israel could have. So it is illegal. And because it is illegal, Israel did not have a right to intercept our boats in international waters. We weren't in Israeli waters at all. And because they didn't have a right to intercept our boats in international waters, any use of force against us was illegal. And they killed 10 people, 5 of them likely executed. 1 of them an American citizen, and the United States was the only country in the Human Rights Council at the UN to vote against adopting this human rights report, this investigation report. The only country. Never did anything about the fact that there's one of their citizens was most likely executed. And there has been no justice for the people that were injured and killed. You know, after all of that, I said I would title my talk, Why Be an Activist? All of the stuff that we did in Gaza is still completely sealed off. Not only is 110 million liters of untreated sewage being dumped into the Mediterranean Sea, but Israel controls where the fishermen can fish, the fishers. You're supposed to have up to 20 nautical miles out where you can fish, but Israel limits Gaza fishers to 3 to 6 nautical miles. So not only do you not have good fish, and about 35,000 people in Gaza rely their families on the fishing industry, but they're also fishing in the most polluted of the water. And all of these businesses and factories destroyed, but when Palestinians then turn to their land, at least we can harvest, there's agricultural land. Israel says it pulls out of Gaza, but it declares a lot of the land near where Israel has set up its border, no-go zones. And that's where one-third of the agricultural land is. So when Palestinians try to go to harvest their parsley or other vegetation that they can use to sell and feed their families, they get shot at by the Israeli army. So Gaza is still in this situation. The rest of Palestine isn't even any better. Why continue this activism? Why be an activist? Because Vali, 75-year-old man from Gaza, who held up his key, likely passed down to him from his parents, and said, for 70 years, and nobody is listening to us, before he set out to march with the Gaza Freedom March. The Gaza Freedom March, thousands of people of Gaza, most of them refugees, marching unarmed to where Israel has set up this artificial border, saying that enough, enough of the blockade. We want to go back home. Most of those refugees, if they stand on a high building top, whatever's left in Gaza, they can see their homes beyond the Gaza borders, but haven't been able to go there. Wanting to go home, a freedom march. And you know what Israel did? Put its snipers on the hilltops surrounding Gaza and shot at the people marching like fish in a barrel. So on the first day of those marches, 17 people were shot dead, 1,500 were injured. And despite that, every Friday for 2 years, people gathered and marched. 224 people were killed, 36,000 injuries. 156 of those injuries resulted in multiple amputations. And yet those people, the amputees, you know what a lot of them did? They formed a amputee soccer team so that they are still playing. Why be an activist? Because in Israel right now, 4,500 Palestinian political prisoners. 200 of them are children. You know how these children are arrested? They're dragged from their beds in the middle of the night. They're woken up at gunpoint. They're blindfolded, put in a military jeep. Their parents aren't allowed to come with them. They are interrogated, kept from eating, kept from using the restroom, told they can't have a lawyer. And then they're thrown in military prison. They are put before a court that has a conviction rate of 99.5%. So these children lose years of their lives. Maybe for throwing a stone, maybe for knowing someone to throw a stone, or maybe for nothing. From those 4,500 that are political prisoners right now, including children, right now, today, 520 of them, no charge at all. No charge, no trial. They don't know why they're being held in Israel, and its law can hold Palestinians without charge for 3 to 6 months. Renewable. So it could be the last day, 6 months, they haven't charged you, they're going to release you. Nope, it was just renewed for another 6 months, for years. 520 are now being held. They call it administrative detention. It is really no due process at all. And so six of those that are without charge have been locked up for months and over a year, especially Kayed Fasfos. He has been on hunger strike for 107 days. He is probably getting close to his last breath in an Israeli hospital. Ala al-Araj, 83 days. Miqdad Qawasmi, 100 days without food, because they are held without charge, separated from their families, and they have nothing to fight with but their bodies. Because there's a village inside Israel. You know, I say where I'm an Israeli citizen, my dad's an Israeli citizen. There are villages inside Israel where there are Israeli citizens, but they're Palestinian, and Israel doesn't want them there. One of those is named Al-Araqib. It's in the southern part of Israel, Al-Naqab, or the Negev, they call it. That village has been demolished 186 times. They don't have homes. They have corrugated tin and tents. And the bulldozers come in and tear it up. And the people get right back and rebuild it. 186 times. And the people get right back up and rebuild it. Because in Jerusalem, Palestinian families are being taken out of their homes, so Jewish families can move in. And so you have situations where Palestinians are in a tent across the street from what was their home for decades, and now a Jewish family moved in. And they don't have much recourse in Israeli courts because the courts are not for them. Just like my student said, the law is not for us. Because in the South Hebron Hills, if any of you have been to that area, thousands of Palestinians live in without being able to be connected to the water system, without being able to rebuild, so that they're living in caves or corrugated tin shacks. And Israel wants to get rid of them. So these are farmers. They live off the land. They live off their animals. And they can't even connect to the water grid so that they can feed their or give water to their animals so they can water their crops. And so what do? They have to buy back water from Israel at four times the price that Israelis pay, water that is confiscated from them because it is on their land. But they can't drill wells. If they make a well to get to the water, Israel comes and demolishes it. And also their caves or their tin shacks, Israel demolishes almost on a weekly basis. They come in with their forces and their bulldozers and flatten. And there is one woman, Farisa Abu Aram. She's from one of these small communities in the South Hebron Hills. And when the bulldozer came to demolish her home, an activist that was there, an Israeli activist, said he could hear the civilian administration tell the soldiers and the bulldozers to not let her take anything out of her home so that she is not able to rebuild. And so when they flattened her home, it was on top of the very little that she had, the pots and pans, her children's school bags. And 1 month later, when her son was trying to rebuild, he was using a generator. You know? And so Israeli forces came in and tried to confiscate that generator from him, and he hung on to it. He hung on to it, and so they shot him in the neck. And he is now completely paralyzed, can only move his eyes, and forget about having a wheelchair in these communities or being able to get rehabilitated. A lot more stories to tell. I'll say one more, because there are so many, and they're the ones that keep us going. Because hopefully one day there won't be another situation like the one where this little girl in Gaza had to endure. Aisha Lulu. She was a 5-year-old girl who had the misfortune of being born in Gaza. But by all reports, she was a really bubbly child until one day something was wrong. And after her parents taking her to different doctors in Gaza, they discovered that she had a brain tumor. They couldn't treat her in Gaza. Israel doesn't let in the medical supplies that they need. But there was a Palestinian hospital in Jerusalem that could treat her and that they said that they would. And so the little girl got permission from Israel to go to this hospital in Maqasid in Jerusalem. But you know what? Her parents didn't get permission to go with her. And they applied and reapplied. Not her mother, not her father, not her aunt, not her uncle, not her neighbor. Everyone that applied around her was denied permission to go with her until the Israeli military granted permission to somebody, but Aisha didn't know them, but it was somebody in Gaza, an elderly woman that would be able to accompany her. And so in tears, Aisha got in a taxi with this woman that she barely knew to go have brain surgery in Gaza, in Jerusalem. And that surgery, though, went well. But she was in such distress because she couldn't be with her family. The doctor, the surgeon, told her parents, do whatever you can to get here because it is affecting her and her recovery that she is so upset. They couldn't get to her. They couldn't get to her. And she stopped talking. And when she closed her eyes for the last time, she was all alone. That's the degree to which Israel controls every aspect of the lives of Palestinians. And so we're activists because people like Ali and Fariza and Kayed, they don't have a choice. They don't have the luxury of asking themselves that question. No, and because we care, right? We care not to leave people to the forces that would inflict this kind of pain and suffering, because we care to create a better world. We know that there are tragedies all over the world. In the Middle East, there are still boatloads of refugees, Syrian refugees trying to make their way to Europe, boats that are still sinking in the Mediterranean because European countries won't give refugees the dignity of letting them become refugees so that they have to risk their lives in the middle of the sea. In this country, all over the country, our very right to vote, right, is being attacked. In Texas, women are living in fear. They don't have the right anymore to control their own bodies because the legislature just enacted this vigilante justice. We have so many people sitting in jail right now, wrongly accused, wrongly convicted, or convicted for very minor crimes and spending their years of their lives in jail. One of them, you know, Henry Hentz. My kids know Henry's name because he sent them dolls that they've made in prison. He's been in jail for 42 years. His co-defendant was let off. He got his conviction overturned. He was white and wealthy, and Henry is black and poor. He's been in jail for 42 years, and as a lawyer who reviewed the evidence in his case, he didn't do it. He didn't do it, but he has exhausted all of his appeals. No judge will look at anything he writes anymore. But he keeps in touch with me. He always asks about my kid, and a few months ago he sent me a letter that said, "I've asked my brother to send you a check. Use it to help the Palestinians. Know that this is but a blade of grass in the bushels that I wish I could give you. And I can't be with you and your friends and your family marching for the great injustices that they are enduring. But know, my friend, that I am with you 1,000%. People like that shouldn't be in jail in this country. It shouldn't be that here in Indiana, at minimum wage, you have to work 74 hours a week to be able to afford a one-bedroom apartment. 91 hours a week if you want to afford a two-bedroom apartment. It shouldn't be in this country that we have 11,000 children that live in poverty in one of the richest country in the world, where children can't find enough to eat. That's why we're activists, and that's why I bring my kids to these things. When I was invited, I asked Michael if I could bring my kids, because I want them to also know, like I came to realize, the privilege that I've had, and to know also that they have a responsibility, not to burden them at this young age, but they also have this innocence that I want them to combine with the knowledge that they're getting, and to be able to hold on to that and to translate it into the work that it's going to take to make this a better place. You know, my daughters, a lot of her and my son's clothes say, "We can change the world." And we put that on a lot of kids' clothes, if you see. We can change the world. But what happens to a lot of us when we get older? Speaking of hunger and children, I want to quote a young 10-year-old girl in this video. Some of you might have seen it on the internet. It was back really in 1990, and she was speaking at a press conference on world hunger in her school, and she said, "I'm here because I care." And she talked about the children just like her dying of hunger around the world, and about her dream of eliminating world hunger, saying, "My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. If we ignore hunger, that light will go out. But if we all help and work together, it will grow and burn free with the potential of tomorrow." 13 years later, that girl traveled to Palestine, and she volunteered with us in the international solidarity movement. And she wrote home to her mom from Palestine. In one of the emails, she wrote, "I'm rambling. Just want to write to my mom and tell her that I'm witnessing this chronic, insidious genocide. And I'm really scared and questioning my fundamental belief in the goodness of human nature. This has to stop. I think it's a good idea for us to drop everything and devote our lives to making this stop. I'm disappointed that this is the base reality of our world and that we, in fact, participate in it. This is not at all what I asked for when I came into this world. This is not what all the people here asked for when they came into this world. This is not the world you and Dad wanted me to come into when you decided to have me. This is not what I meant when I looked at Capitol Lake and said, 'This is the wide world and I'm coming to it.' I did not mean that I was coming into a world where I could live a comfortable life and possibly, with no effort at all, exist in complete unawareness of my participation in genocide." 2 weeks later, that girl, Rachel, stood in front of that military bulldozer that ran her over and crushed her to death. Minutes before, she was shouting at the soldier sitting in the cab of that bulldozer, saying, "What would your mother think of what you were doing?" I don't know what he thought when he ran her over. That was 18 years ago that Rachel was killed, but her words live on. And one of the things that she wrote home to her mother that I think is especially poignant for us, she wrote, "Just hearing about what you're doing makes me feel less alone, less useless, less invisible. The international media and our government aren't going to tell us that we are effective, important, justified in our work, courageous, intelligent, valuable. We have to do that for each other. And one way we can do that is by continuing our work visibly." Indeed, she said, "We can choose to stand in solidarity with those working for their lives, or we can do nothing." And I know that, again, every single one of you is here because we care about creating a better world. But sometimes we can get down. I mean, I get down. We get overwhelmed. We can doubt our effectiveness. But let us just have more of these gatherings and uplift each other and remind ourselves that we are powerful and keep on with the optimism and childlike belief in an ability to do anything. My daughter actually helps me with that. You know, a few years ago, she probably won't remember this, but she was about 3, and we were in a car, and I put on a Palestinian song about resistance and about fighting injustice, and she asked me what it meant, and so it was in Arabic, and so I translated to her and told her it was because Israel took our land, and we want to fight for our land. And when she learned that Israel took our land, she's like, "Well, we have to get it back, Mama." And I said, "Well, yes, we do." And she said, "Well, we have to put on our superhero costumes and fight them." And she said, "I'll be Batgirl, and you're Wonder Woman, and Baba's Batman, and Diara's Superman, and we can fight." You know? Do you remember? No, you don't remember. I remember. And you know, I see a lot of capes in this room. And our capes might not make us, you know, superhuman. It doesn't make us fly, but working together, I think with the knowledge that it takes us to make change, and believing that we are effective, you know, we are a damn strong force. And I am really, really honored again to be standing here with every single one of you and going forth to continue our work, really creating the better world that we know can come about, that we envision, and that we and they deserve. So thank you again for all that you do.
You've been listening to attorney activist Huwaida Araf speaking in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.